Welcome to Your Day Off, the podcast that shares, loves, and inspires the hair industry.
What's up, Tone? That was fun.
Oh, that was great, man. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing awesome. Hey, so we just talked to Peru Sarshar. So he'll correct me in the first couple minutes. But hey, if you don't know who Peru is, you need to know his journey. He's done it all, man. He's done just about everything you can possibly do in our industry.
Yeah, you're right. He was a hairdresser. He was a distributor. He has been a salon owner. He has been a product developer.
I think what he's best known for, certainly that's consistent through all of it, is that he just does amazing brand management.
Yeah, and he has, you're right, personal brands. That's what he does.
He builds brands. So I guess there's no better person to tell you about Peruse than Peruse.
Here we go.
Welcome to Your Day Off. Today we are going to sit down with Peruse Sarshar. Is that how you pronounce it?
So after 20 some years of knowing each other, you still don't know? I'm kidding. No, not many people know, but it's Sarshar.
So Peruse, thank you very much for joining Your Day Off. Before we get started, I certainly want to thank Ashley Gray, who owns Ash Salon, who gave us the back of her salon so we could speak today. And of course, I'm sitting next to my boy, Tony.
What up?
Hey, so Peruse, welcome, man. Thanks for doing the show.
But first and foremost, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
If anything, I'm grateful more than anything to be here with my two of my oldest friends. Uh-huh. As you guys know, we go back a long way. And some crazy days when I was a little bit more wild back then, but but it's good. It's nothing is more satisfying and fulfilling than to be here with two friends and doing this and just talking some industry talk.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And before we get into a lot of that, obviously Corey and I, we've gotten to see you from when you were young until where you are now. Your story has been pretty fascinating, you know.
It's been a great journey.
It has been a great journey.
Thank you.
So before we get into a lot of that other stuff, let's share your story with everybody else.
Sure, let me give you a background. I was born, believe it or not, of all places, in Tehran, Iran, and my family had to escape.
Was that in like 1978?
Yeah, I mean, we can say I was born in 1978, but anyways, my family had to escape because of my father's, job, political ties and whatnot. And, an unfortunate thing happened in that country. I don't know very much about it, mm-hmm. except that it's just a beautiful place with a lot of history.
Have you been back?
I unfortunately cannot go back again mm-hmm. because of family issues and whatnot, but political stuff, but it's just a beautiful place that and what we see of it in the news and media unfortunately gets a lot of bad press.
Yeah, sure. I have clients who've been there and they've done tours and they just say it's gorgeous.
Yeah, they say it's beautiful. And just to give you guys an idea, so I came to the United States. You know, my family came here on political asylum, and I was a kid who spoke no English and didn't know much about the political climate. And for our mm-hmm. safety, we were moved to, the government moved us to Washington, D.C., in the beginning in Virginia. So growing up, my first day of school, just a group of kids asked me where I'm from, my sister and I, where we're from, and we got attacked. Mm-hmm. And because of the hostages and all this other stuff that we didn't know anything about. So we got attacked, we got beaten up.
Wow.
And my father, when he first came to the U.S., he couldn't go to work for the government. So my father is a Hall of Fame martial artist, so he had to go and, he went and started...
In Iran?
Worldwide. He's known.
Really?
Yeah, he's known around the world in the martial arts world.
I didn't
world.
Know there was a martial arts
Hall of Fame. Oh, yeah. I mean, things have changed since now that the UFC and the Octagon and the Barbarians and all the other stuff. But having said that, so, I spent the majority of my life after school. I mean, when the first day we got beat up, my mom was like, you guys are going to learn how to protect yourself. So right. I spent from the age of 9 to 19, I spent every day after school going to karate training. I became a competitor and somehow made it through there. And I became an instructor after a while because that's how my father wanted me to teach. That's why I love standing in front of people and, talking and teaching. To this day, I love coaching and teaching.
And you're quite good at it.
Oh, thank you.
Great at it, I should say.
Thank you so much. And I've had a lot of practice, and you know, but I was taught in a way to deliver results. And so when I come into a salon and teach, whether it's management, whether it's haircutting, whatever it is, blow drying, goal setting, I'm after results, you know. Growing up, you know, I was getting into a lot of trouble, and my punishment was to go to my mom's salon. My mom had a couple, you know, got into the business. And, when I would go there, she was like, you know, you're not going to just hang out here and do nothing. You're going to work. So they had me washing hair. I wasn't wrapping perms, but I was rinsing perms and, you know, back in the '80s doing all that stuff.
Neutralizing.
Sure. Yeah. So what happened after a while, a couple of guys that were there, you know, the two things she taught people, and my friends all make, you know, of course have made fun of me all throughout my life growing up, because my mom taught me two things, hair and how to cook, which is really funny. And so, you know,
my wife's grateful that I can do both those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's not a bad skill to have around women. But anyway, so I sort of started from there. I started cutting hair when I was 13, 14 years old. I kept up with it. A lot of folks made, you know, again, growing up, I was always told, like, you know, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? This is dumb. This is it. Yeah, I got all sorts of stuff.
Right.
But, and my buddies didn't understand because I was a jock, but I was a jock who was cutting hair after school. So until they realized that, hey, all the cheerleaders are hanging out in his basement because he's giving them, you know, beauty advice and, you know, consultations.
Is that what we're calling it now?
Well, whatever, cutting there. I had no clue what I was doing. I was lying to everyone, like, oh, I can do a bob. Oh, I could cut your hair this way. Or I could, you know, I wasn't lying, meaning I just wanted to cut people's hair. And so I would say anything for them to let me do it.
Are you just, you saw it. You did it. You might not understood it, but you saw it and you were doing it.
Yeah, I was doing my best to just make it work. And so I grew up in that environment, but through that environment, I got exposed to a lot of different things. I got exposure to a lot of artists at a young age because my mom was very up on things. I knew about Tony and Guy in high school, you know, or Trevor Sorby back then. And, you know, when my friends were talking about, like, Tony Dorsett, the running back of the Dallas Cowboys, I was like, well, what about Trevor Sorby, the guy who does the wedge cuts or whatever? And you're like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, what is a wedge cut? You know, or what do you mean by that? So became obsessed at a very young age, and I picked up the scissors, and I just couldn't put it down. But I knew then, when I was about 16, 17 years old, I knew I wanted to learn how to make products. And I...
Hold on. Yeah. So what how'd you know? Like, what was it that, spoke to you? What did you see?
Well, the funny thing was that I had a, there was a period of, I thought I had dandruff once. I didn't have dandruff. I had dry scalp.
Right.
And just like every other schmo out there that thinks they have dandruff, I was like, oh, I have dry scalp. So I was given a shampoo by Redken. It was a dandruff shampoo. And, you know, when I used that shampoo and it made my scalp clear up, I was like, well, wow, if that did that and that smells so good, what else is there? You know, and I just started playing with Redken products because that's all there was back then, Redken and Nexus. And I think there was one other brand. I can't remember the name, but Lamar or what are they, like old line, Modafini. I mean, these were like old lines. And I started playing with them. And even back then, I was like, wow, what if you made these better? What if, you know, if you can help somebody with dry scalp, what else can you do?
Right.
And what if they were shaped differently? What if they smelled differently? What if the packaging was different?
I mean, you had all these thoughts at 16?
At 16 years old, wow, yeah. Man. And people were like, you know, are you crazy? You know, what are you talking about? You know, what the hell is
it? I'm kind of thinking that now. Like, at 16, why are we thinking about bottle shapes?
It was just one of those things I was obsessed with then. And I didn't, you know, I'm not a trust fund kid. I've always had to do everything on my own. Came when my family left, you know, and came to the U.S., my parents had to start over twice. You know, they lost everything, they made it, they lost everything, they made it.
Right.
So I was exposed to this at a young age. I was exposed to a revolution. I was exposed to haircut. It was just a very strange childhood. And I was in a karate school. And I spoke several languages when I came here, but I didn't speak any English. And then, so it all started to sort of transform and it started coming together. And when I was done with school and it was time to go to college, I knew I also wanted to go to hair school. I wanted to do something. And I'd been doing a bunch of apprenticeships. And so before all that, I was, one day, I was, I'll tell you a funny story. When I was in the ninth grade, my mom one day was like, hey, we need a perm model. And I'm like, what? And they're like, we need a perm model. I'm like, all right, cool. So I showed up. And they did like a spiral perm on me. And I don't know
how long was your hair.
It was pretty long, but it was. I looked like, you know, it was pretty bad. You know, the results were not good. And I went to school, and I remember everyone laughing at me, making fun of me. You know, they're making fun of me. So I shaved my head and didn't cut my hair for several years. And there was a period when I was really down. I would think I was in towards my 11th grade, towards the, at the end of 11th grade, and I was. I wasn't sure. I had a little bit of a heartbreak. Didn't know what it was. Right. I was a late bloomer. Didn't know anything. And nothing would make me feel good. You know, anyone would talk to me. Nothing was changing. Mm-hmm. So, there was one day where my sister's like, "Oh, you should go get a haircut from somebody other than mom." And I'm like, "Where?" And she's like, "Oh, you should go to this place called Bruno D'Assange and get a haircut there. You'll love the way they work." And I'm like, "Well, where is it?" She's like, "Well, there's one in D.C., one in New York, and you would love it." And so I was like, okay. So I convinced all my friends. I'm like, hey, let's skip school and go to New York. And they're like,
go to New York for the day?
For the day. And they're like, are you crazy? And I'm like, no, we'll go. We'll take a train. And they're like, how are we going to do that? I was like, I'll take my mom's credit card and we'll buy tickets. And we did. I got grounded forever. But afterwards, but we did it, you know, and we ended up going up there. And when I was going up there, along the way, I ran into someone at Union Station. I didn't even know. I mean, if you even knew how we got ourselves a Union Station or what we were doing. And so I ran into someone.
You didn't take an Uber.
No, there was no Ubers. You know, there was no cell phone. So I get to Union Station. I run into somebody who's an old friend. And out of the blue, he brings a book out of his bag called Think and Grow Rich. And he gives it to me. And he's like, where are you going? And I'm like, I'm going to New York. And he goes, for what? I'm like, I'm going to go get a haircut. And he starts laughing. He goes, do your parents know? And luckily, there were no cell phones. Because otherwise, he would have texted my mom, and she would have beat my ass before I even made it to New York.
Hey, my ass is getting on the train.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, so I got on the train. I went to New York, and I start reading along the way. I start reading this book. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm just looking at this thing, and I'm obsessed, you know. And it was all about thinking big and, you know, the law of attraction even back then. And so then I went in and then I meet a guy and we're sitting there. And prior to that, most of the men, I hadn't met any cool macho or guys like us who were in the business. Everybody I've met was just a little different. Mm-hmm. And so I meet these guys. Yeah. And I meet these guys and they're like, so one of them's like, oh, well, this is what we're going to do. And he cut my hair and he and I are still friends. Mm-hmm. And we actually still work together. Fast forward years later.
Right.
And the way I felt after that haircut and the way I was, it changed my life. That haircut changed my life. It took my heartbreak away. I looked great. I felt great. I walked away feeling like $1 million.
All from a haircut.
All from a haircut. I hadn't felt like that in years because you have to understand, I was a child who went through war, right. You know, essentially. And so, and then I got in the U.S. and my family's hiding and we're escaping here. We're escaping. We escaped many different places to get here.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that was the first time. I think there was two events in my life as a kid that really changed everything. One was the first time I saw a palm tree in Los Angeles. And, you know, and there was, I don't know what it was about a palm tree that just made my, you know, it made me smile. And then the second time I smiled big back then was this haircut. And so I went to him and I said, listen, back then I was teaching karate. I was competing in karate and he wanted to learn karate, this hairstylist. And he was between D.C. and New York. And I was like, look, I'll make a deal with you. And he goes, what? I'm like, I cut hair in my parents' basement. Can you come tutor me? And he starts laughing. He goes, well, why don't you just come help out at the shop? And I said, I will. And I'm like, well, what do you want for it? Because, you know, I didn't have a lot of, you know, access
so
to a
lot
of.
You paid him to work at the shop.
Well, I didn't have access to a lot of. He goes, well, what?
That guy's a genius.
Well,
by the way.
Well, he's like, well, let's do this. I said, what? He goes, let's exchange services. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, you teach me karate. Mm-hmm. I want to learn how to defend myself, and I'll teach you how to cut hair. And it started right there and then. And then our relationship didn't stop. We became friends, and I wasn't going to go to anyone else to cut my hair.
Sure.
And I was. That's where it all began. And when it began, and I was done with everything, and it was time to go to school, I didn't know which direction to go to. And I was cutting hair. I wanted to learn the product business. There was a lot of different things I wanted to do. A lot of my friends who were, you know, even later on in life, who had access to creating their own businesses, you know, had to support, you know, family support and all this other stuff. But like I said, I wasn't a trust fund kid. I was one of those people that always did everything myself.
You had to work.
I had to work, and I still do. And I don't know any other way. And so I ended up in hair school. And when I ended up in hair school, I ended up at Graham Webb, where we all met.
Sure.
And when I was there, the people that were running Graham Webb, they realize, they're like, oh, this guy can cut hair, you know, and he knows a little bit more than everyone else, and he can sell, and he understands color, you know, which is very unusual for a student. So the owner of the school at that point, or the woman who was running it, is like, we're just going to stick you on the floor, and this is where you're going to be. And if you come here and work your butt off and work hard, then I'll get you out of here in 6 months, 7 months. I think I have the record for getting out of, out of school. And she gave me my 1,500 hours. I don't even know if it was legal.
That sounds shady.
Yeah, probably. I would say 100% shady. But she worked the hell out of me and a few other guys. Mm-hmm. And we actually got the school written up in Vogue magazine because we were using those color guns with the Fermisi color and so on and so forth.
God, I forgot about those.
Yeah, and we created a nice business for them there.
Sure.
And so from there, I knew, I was like, look, if I'm going to get good at this, I said in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to have to learn so many different aspects of this. And I don't know if it was a good thing for me to plan out my life like that or if it was a bad thing. Bad thing, good and bad. You know, if there was a negative, well, I set a life for myself that took me around the world, took me to many different places, gave me a lot of opportunities. But unlike a lot of my other friends, I didn't have the opportunity to settle down. I didn't have an opportunity to start a family. Right. I didn't have because I was always on the road and I was working. And I'm like, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing? How can I get better and bigger and that sort of stuff? And a lot of my other buddies who got into the business, you know, established themselves, got a clientele, bought a house, you know, created a little net worth for them, so whatever you want to call it for themselves, built a life. And so, but I was the guy who was like, okay, now I've done this, I'm going to go to the next thing. And so the next thing, you know, I started working at this, the people from Desange had this European Express salon concept, so they hire me to work in one. Then I ended up running one. Then I hired all our buddies, if you remember. And then without licenses, I was like, oh, you guys should go on the floor and cut hair.
We're still in school.
So slow down just a little bit. How old were you at this? I mean, you're managing a salon at what age?
I was 20 years old. And I just turned... Actually, no, I was 19 years old. And 19 and a half years old, I was managing a salon. By the time I was 20, I was managing the whole chain.
Wow.
And I was running an entire chain. And it was cool. And I was very excited about it.
Did it feel overwhelming at all?
It didn't feel... It did and it didn't. I was just... psyched about it. It didn't overwhelm me. What it did was it taught me a lot, but I didn't know what I was doing because I was just hiring my friends and I was trying to work in an environment. I realized right there and then that the beauty industry, especially salons, lack structure. There was no structure. And I was going to school and I was studying, you know, and I was reading and anything I can get my hands on business wise, I was studying and reading, you know. So that's when I realized, I'm like, wow, there's a problem in this business.
A very mature 20-year-old.
Yeah, and I think the maturity part came... I was mature and I was immature. Just like most men, until I hit the age of 40, I had no idea what the hell is going on in the world. But,
But you've been through so much more than the average 20-year-old. Yeah. You know, and so I think it just, I guess, maybe pushed you to want and desire a lot more than the average 20-year-old.
Isn't that what a lot of people talk about the immigrant story as well? Coming in,
I am your.
Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say it's very fair, and I am your typical. You know, even though I was a kid, immigrant story, and I wasn't. You know, if those things hadn't happened in that country, my life would have been different. I would have ended up in England going to boarding school, then to Switzerland, the boarding school, then the U.S. going to college, and then back to Iran.
Right.
And but that didn't happen for me. You know, I was a child who was stuck in a war. You know, like basically a war, and I had to do the best I could with what I have. You know, available or access to.
Right.
So that was the beginning. And then, you know, I was running these salons, not knowing what I was doing, realized there's no structure. And then from there, I went to these guys and said, hey, I want to move to New York. And they're like, you're so young. I'm like, I want to move to New York. I want to work in the top salon.
Right.
So then I
did. Now we're at 20 now, right?
Essentially? 21. Right. You know, getting to 21. And they're like, well, what about these places? We want to open more for you. And I realized, I'm like, it's fun. It's fun managing these salons. This was exciting, this chain salon business. I'm out. See you. Peace. Right. I want to move on. So I did. I moved on, and I started working in a salon, a very, you know, high-grade salon. Immediately, I had to take up my haircutting level my haircutting skill, to a different level.
Sure.
To be able to charge what I wanted to charge, to be able to survive, to be able to eat, because every time I make these moves, most people around me, especially my support system, would bail on me or would say, like, you're crazy or you should stay here. Be happy you have this. And don't move on any further. And then I just never listened. I was like, no, my heart's telling me to do this, and this is what I'm doing. So I did that. And then from there, I got into, a little bit of session work. Never done it before. Was okay at it. I wasn't the best session artist. I think my strength is in haircutting because I love hair. Like, I love watching Tony work. Like, right. When I watch you work, I think the color is beautiful, but I'm not a colorist.
Right, but I
see haircuts. You know what I mean? And so
I totally get that, actually.
You know, so I started, you know, I fell in love with the concept of cutting hair, and I was like, well, how do I just do great haircuts? How do I take it to the next level? What can I do? That sort of thing. So I started working there. And then from there, I did a complete opposite. I had an opportunity to stay in New York,
right.
And there was a couple of big names about to open salons, and my friends were like, hey, if you do this, you can become a multimillionaire by being a hairstylist. I decided to do something crazy. I decided to go work for a distributor in Charlotte, North Carolina. And people were like,
whoa, like, Charlotte.
Yeah, from New York City to Charlotte, North Carolina, ended up in Richmond. And, you know, and it was so funny because I walk into this place.
I'm sure it was a different Charlotte back then than it is today.
Oh, yeah. There was no downtown.
None of the banking systems or anything like that.
No. It's not as cool as it looks now. But so I walk into this office with these Southern guys and, they're, you know, big dudes. And they're looking at my little skinny tail. And so they're looking at my skinny tail and they're like, boy, you need to eat. You know, what's your name? You know, so they couldn't pronounce my name, so they called me Bubba. And so I became Bubba, the young sales guy from D.C. So what was happening then was that there was a lot, you know, right now in the beauty industry, unfortunately, things have changed where, as you know, Tony, there aren't that many distributors left.
Right.
And, you know, it's like a couple of big guys and some small guys. But back then, there was about 500 families or so that had all these really cool distributor businesses.
Wow.
And there was a BBSI, and there was a body, and there was a lobbying body, and all that other stuff. But so right away, these guys are like, we're going to put you out in the D.C. market. We think you'll be great because you're the first sales consultant we've hired that's a hairdresser. So that gives us an advantage. And I was like, listen, I'll do whatever. I just want to learn. I just want to learn how to sell. I want to learn how distribution works. So I went out my first couple of weeks, and I was so excited. And it was awful for me because after a couple of weeks, I realized I'm like, okay, I'm going to go broke because no one's buying anything from me. all the big distributors were, you know, they for whatever I tried to do, all these big distributors would come in and be like, oh, we'll give you a rack. We'll do this. We'll give you that. And screw this guy. So I changed my strategy a little bit. I was like, okay, well, you know, these guys are walking around in suits. They're older guys or older women. And so my advantage is that I'm a hairdresser. I speak their lingo.
Right.
And I have to stand out. So I bought myself some rollerblades and had no idea how to rollerblade. And I started rollerblading around D.C. and so I was the guy on the rollerblades that would show up and sell stuff. Some guy actually has a picture. I ran into him in the airport. He's like, I got a picture of you holding onto the back of a bus with your distributor bags and shampoos flying out or whatever.
Hey, we need that picture, bro. Yeah, what do we get? Yeah.
So I actually got his number and I'm gonna contact him. But
Stay tuned to Instagram.
Right. So what happened was I realized real quickly when I was out there selling, I'm like, okay, I can't compete against these people. And these people that I'm working with are really big in the South, but they're trying to get into the Mid-Atlantic. And they've thrown me, 22-year-old, 20th, whatever I was, me into this mix.
So, you keep finding yourself in these situations.
Yeah, quite a bit. So I said, like, okay, what am I going to do? So I'm going to learn the salon business. So I started, you know, reading. I went back to reading old materials. I went back to a lot of inspirational, motivational books that I read in the past. And I'm like, what if I bring some of this stuff into the salon business? And what some of my experiences are.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, you know, picking certain clients that I would work with, salons, and I had about 22 accounts. Most of my counterparts had 500-600 accounts. I had 23 accounts.
Right.
But I started feeding these people information. I started training them a certain way. They started letting me work with their hairdressers because they realized I have skills.
Right.
And I was doing the same number in terms of sales out of 23 salons and most of the guys I was working with at 500 salons.
Wow. And bravo, so, sir.
Yeah, that's so impressive.
Yeah, yeah. So the reason and it really helped. I mean, I wasn't going gangbusters, but it was good for me, you know what I mean? For where I was.
Right.
And I had like literally when I say competitors, when I'd go into a salon, I had like 8 other salespeople on my tail with more to give, with more incentives, with spiffs, things I didn't have, you know.
Right.
So I've always been, you know, kind of used to working with one arm tied. Mm-hmm. And I'm good at it. You know, that's why I can go into these distressed situations now, which we'll get into shortly, into companies and help out the way I can help out, you know, and so on and so forth. But yeah, so I did that. And then The owner of the distributor came to me one day, or one of the guys that I'm actually really good friends with now on mm-hmm. Facebook, because we haven't seen each other in years.
Everybody's Facebook
yeah.
friends.
And no, he came to me and he's like, listen, Peruz, I want to have a talk with you. And he's like, what? I'm like, I just think it's a shame if you don't go out and do something on your own. And if you keep doing this, we love having you. But if I can give you any piece of advice, go out there and do something, man, because you got you see different than everyone else.
Because you grew up as the underdog. I mean, every situation seems like you were an underdog, and you were able to just take that and use that to your advantage, to just your drive to make sure you right. didn't just quit, or just it's too hard. I'm going to go ahead and do something a little bit easier. And which a lot of people nowadays seem to have that kind of, Well, let me take a different path, because that path looks like there's a little bit of a roadblock. Yeah. So
when you grow up, seeing, waking up one day and you walk on the streets and everybody in your neighborhood has guns. And, when you wake up with like in the middle of the night as a kid and you see bombs traveling back and forth and people shooting each other, you kind of learn, you grow up really fast. You know? And I hear people all the time here are like, oh, go in there and nuke them or bomb them. And I'm always like, dude, have you ever heard a bomb explode? Have you ever heard a damn gun shut off? It's pretty scary. And it's not, there's nothing cool about it.
Right.
So,
especially from a kid's perspective. You guys were leaving.
Exactly. So, you're right. I was, the underdog thing started at a really young age. And I kind of used it to motivate and inspire myself, and I still do. Because in a lot of ways, when I walk into a situation, even though I go in and I know people and they're like, hey, Peru, I'm still an underdog, because I go in with a bigger idea every time, or I go in challenging more every time.
If I can just interject here, over the years when we speak, that's where the conversation's always gone, right? Like, we go in for one thing, and you're always pushing, you're always trying to grow the conversation or to grow the industry.
Yeah, that's always been, like a quest. And so then from there, when I left the distributorship, I had this crazy idea, and I was like, I'm going to start a magazine, a beauty magazine. And being the fool that I am, I didn't know anything about trademarks. I did, but I did a horrible job doing the trademark. And I launched a concept, which someone else has taken and is running with now, called Beauty Coach. But I have all the proof. I was the first beauty coach guy.
Uh-huh.
So I would read magazines back then. I realized, I'm like, no one's talking about hair or beauty in these magazines. It's all fashion. Now there's like beauty supplements and Beauty 101 and InStyle Beauty and New Beauty and whatever. And so I decided to, I was like, okay, if I'm going, and I went to a group of my friends. I'm like, hey, guys, I have an idea. And they're like, oh, shit, now what does he want to do? And I was like, hey, let's launch. Yeah, I'm like, let's launch a magazine. And they're like, are you out of your mind? We don't have this. We don't have that. I'm like, we have the internet. And one of my buddies.
Oh, so this was later on. This wasn't like pre-internet.
No, this is like.
Well, early on, though, right?
Yeah, early on. It was kind of early on. And they're like, how the hell are we going to do it on the internet? And I was like, there's this thing coming out called the internet. We can do it on there. And one or two, three guys knew about it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, listen. And they're like, and I said, look, all we can do is practice, print it, put it out. Anyways, so I went to all my friends, hairdressers, estheticians, everyone. And back then, when nobody knew what the hell content was, and I got everybody to start writing content. I'm like, write me about this. What's facial? How do I take a bath? How do you do this? It's all about these how-tos in beauty.
Right.
And then, and around the same time, I launched another concept called Do Your Hair. And Do Your Hair was, I was young, a lot of energy, and Do Your Hair was very similar to Beauty Coach, but Do Your Hair was, I would have blow-drying classes, because as you know, most stylists are pretty weak in that area,
yeah.
So I would train stylists, or I would train consumers, but when I would trade the consumers, I had these private label products that I made called Do Your Hair products, again, no patent, no trade, it was like, whatever, it was like, mm-hmm. I might as well be selling this stuff from the back of my trunk or whatever, or off my skateboard.
Rollerblades,
exactly. But anyways, people would come in, they learned how to blow dry hair, and then I would sell them these kits, these do your hair kits. So that started, and it was garnering a lot of attention, but I didn't have the resources to keep these things going back then. I didn't know how to, I didn't know how to quite.
By resources, you mean money.
Money, and sometimes, money isn't everything. Contacts, connections. Uh-huh. Just knowing what the hell I'm doing, and just you're there, you're this one guy, you have an idea, and a bunch of people are standing around. They're like, okay, what is he gonna do next?
Right.
And so I didn't have those thought partners that are available nowadays, because mm-hmm. so much more has happened. So I ended up. A guy approaches me and says, hey, I have an idea, and I'm like, what's your idea? And he goes, well, why isn't there, other than Johnson & Johnson's baby shampoo, why isn't there anything else out there? And I'm like, I don't know. How the hell do I know? I don't know. Yeah, whatever. So he's like, can I hire you to, you know, give me, consult me? So I was like, okay. So the guy hires me. Next thing you know, we're flying all over the country as I'm doing this other stuff. No clue what was about to happen to my life. We're flying around the country, and I end up at a lab in Minnesota called Tyro Industries. It doesn't exist any longer. Bob Waugh and Wally, I can't remember Wally's last
name. Aren't most of the products made in Minnesota?
They used to be. It used to be the hair care capital of the world. So right. I go to Minnesota. I see Aveda. I see, you know, all this, and you know, see all these beautiful products being made. And I was like, oh, my God, what a great opportunity. So we go into this place, and so the guy, the gentleman challenges me. He's like, look, you know, Johnson & Johnson has a pH of 14. It's like Novocaine and blah, 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 blah. I challenge you to make a neutral, a set pH 7 tear-free shampoo. I'm like, huh? And he's like, I want you to make a pH 7 tear-free shampoo. I had no idea about formula. I didn't know anything about product development. I didn't know anything about product formulation.
So was this guy that was asking you to do this, was he in the industry?
No, he wasn't in the industry. He came from a tech industry, and he was just this crazy entrepreneur. Best salesman I've ever met in my life.
Wow.
And entrepreneur meaning risk. The guy had balls. I mean, he would take risks like you wouldn't believe. But I learned a lot. And so we created a company called Jungle Care.
Yeah,
you guys remember Jungle Care.
Sure,
so,
absolutely.
So, and then he comes to me and goes, and I thought we were going to sell this stuff.
By the way, I think my kids grew up on Jungle Care.
Oh, yeah. So it's funny. So he came to me and goes, I want to sell this stuff in salons. And I'm like, huh? And he's like, make me a famous product brand that's for kids in salons. I'm like, how the hell am I going to do that? No, I can't even get stylists to sell a regular shampoo, let alone a shampoo to a mom for their kid, you know? So it was... an incredible experience. It turned into several product lines for teens, tweens. I got to learn everything about every sort of market you can imagine. I traveled 47 states talking to families, kids, launching it. I turned it into a haircutting concept, turned it into a photo shoot concept. Wow. It became so interesting and unique that we were asked to go to different countries around, I don't know how many, upteen countries we went to around the world. And it was just, it was unique, but it was wearing me out because the guy I worked with was just so crazy. He would just take more risk and more risk and more risk. So you never know when money was there, money wasn't there. So I, you know, as this happened, I one day I'm at a hair show in Pennsylvania. It was some weird ski resort in Pennsylvania. It was a Davidson hair show. Mm-hmm. And probably one of the cheesiest hair shows I've to date, you know, at this mountain lodge. People are drunk and, you know, walking around drinking during the show and all this other stuff. And so the Altieri brothers were there, you know, the famous Altieri brothers. Yep. So the Altieri brothers approached me and they're like...
Did they approach you dancing?
Well, I was always fascinated by the by Tony Ricardo. Uh-huh. And so they came to the booth and I'm like, holy shit, it's the Altieri brothers, you know, and I always knew about them.
Right.
And they're like, we're blown away by this thing. And I'm like, by this kid's line?
By the Jungle line?
Yeah. And they're like, yeah, how the hell did you come up with this idea? And I'm like, well, that guy over there, he's crazy. You know, he got me to do this and this and this and this. And so right away, I became friends with the Altieris. And through the Altieris, I met my one of my thought partners now who lives in Australia. His name is Daniel Tenaglia, incredible hairstylist. And at that point, he was traveling with a guy named Angus Mitchell from Paul Mitchell.
Right.
So Angus, Daniel, and I just became buddies. And every show we were at, we'd always be together. We would always talk. And
so you weren't working together at this point. You would just get together and
We were just at shows, and you know, I was
creating a friendship.
They were wild. I was crazy. They were wild. I wasn't as wild as them. I wish I was, but I just didn't have the balls to do some of the things that those guys were doing. And they were like superstars because at the end of every show, there was like women lined up and, you know, all that stuff.
No,
sort
I totally
of
remember them. Yeah. And, you know, at the shows and how they were the must-sees.
Right. So then so then Daniel, my friend, comes along and says, hey, my family wants to sell this stuff in Australia and it wants to launch a kids line in Australia. Would you be willing to do it? And we also want to do the photography campaigns in Australia because I was doing I was producing a lot of photo shoots and I became known as a guy who, if you pay him X, he's going to deliver you like 10 times.
Right.
And so photographers wanted to work with me, but there was one guy in particular I stuck to and we're still friends, even though he's become famous and I'm not. He still works with me. I'm lucky enough. But anyway, so we ended up, in Australia. And when we ended up in Australia, we were supposed to go there for 2 weeks. And I was like, well, this place is great. I'm going to stay longer. So I ended up staying a lot longer. And in Australia, I discovered a lot about hair, salons, haircutting, you know, the shows we were doing in Australia, when we were doing platform work, and, you know, throughout this time, I'd become a platform artist, And when we were doing a lot of the platform work in Australia, what was happening was that their hair shows are open to consumers. So we were dealing with consumers and professionals in these shows.
It's crowded enough with just all the hairdressers in these shows, right? Yeah. I can't imagine consumers.
And it was so cool, you know, and it was just such a different place. And everybody had such an open mind, and no idea was a bad idea. And every day was a good day, mate. You know, like every day was just good day,
mate.
Yeah, good day. And there was no worries and, you know, whatever. And it was really cool. And then the other part that made me stay that I liked about it, too, is they think, I went to a store one day and I was trying to buy a shirt. And one of the first few days I was there, and these girls were like, "Hey, is your accent real?" And I'm like,
"What? In Australia?"
Yeah. And I'm like, "Yeah." And they're like, "Yeah, you're a real American?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And they're like, I'm like, "Well, this isn't so bad. You know, even the girls like it here. They like our accent here." So I was like, "Oh, I should hang around here for a little while." So I did.
How long did you end up staying?
Quite a while, you know, months and months and mm-hmm. months. And so I stayed for quite. So then there came time, and they were like, you know, listen, the guys from the U.S. called me, and they're like, "We want you to come back to the United States. We need your help, mm-hmm. and because we want to move from the salon business into Nordstrom's." I'm like, "What are you talking about? We built all these distributors." He's like, "It doesn't." I mean, he was crazy. He's like, "We're gonna go to the Nordstrom's."
This is the Jungle Care guy, yeah. Still.
Can you come back? So I hadn't collected a salary in a while because the Australians were paying me. He owed me a bunch of money. So he was like, "Hey, get some." I was like, "Listen, before I come back, I don't know how many times I'm going to be in this part of the world. I think I'm going to go to Bali." And he's like, "Are you crazy? We need you back. You're supposed to be there for 2 weeks. It's like 2 years. You know, what the hell is wrong with?" So I was like, "Come on, man. Let me just go to Bali first. And then I'll see you in a couple of weeks." And he's like, "Okay." And I was like, "You owe me some money." And so he's like, "Go and get the money from the Australian guys."
Sounds so shady.
No,
Peru.
So listen.
I'm listening.
So anyway, I end up from Australia in Bali, and when I went to the Australian distributor, whose father was one of my best friend's dads. You know, at that point, Daniel and I were working very close. He's like, "Look, we owe you guys like $60-some thousand US." I was like, "I'll take it." He's like, "Really?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'll take it all in cash." So I get this cash. I go to Bali.
Oh, that's dangerous.
My first day in Bali, I'm exchanging currency. And I needed a break from haircutting, from hair, from everything. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I didn't want to go back and do a kids thing again in the U.S. But I was interested in learning the prestige market, the Nordstrom's, Neiman Marcus, that all that sort of stuff. So my first day in Bali, I exchanged $400 Australian, and I get 3 million rupiahs, you know, Indonesian money.
You're a millionaire.
I was like, "Holy crap, I'm a millionaire." 6 months, you know, I was like, I ended up staying there for quite a while and until my money ran out. But when I was there, the thing that I was exposed to constantly were I was always at these beautiful resorts, and there was always these wealthy couples on honeymoons. Every time I would sit with them or sit next to some of them, there was always a woman yelling at the guy about his grooming. "Look at your feet. They're disgusting. Look at your hand. Clean your ears, your nose hair." So after a while, I'm like, "Huh, maybe there's something here."
Right.
And I started, you know, looking into it. As I was sitting there, I went through my backpack that I'd been traveling with for a while, and I had the first Bliss catalog with one of the first Bliss catalogs with me. So I was like, "Well, how can I create Bliss for men?" Where I knew right away that, you know, what men know is through a father figure, or what men know is through what their girlfriend bought them or what their wife bought them. You know, so it's usually Gillette or the Clinique soap that the wife brought home from Bloomingdale's that he doesn't know what the hell to do with.
Sure.
So I was like, if I take everything I know from the women's world, instill it into the men's world, maybe I'm on to something. And I came back to the U.S. I started working, went back, learned the prestige market, learned that whole thing at the previous job. But he knew what I was doing, and he was kind enough to allow me to go after my dream. And that was to create a portal for men where men could come and learn about grooming and then purchase products every time they were educated. So I started a concept called the Grooming Lounge.
Sure.
And when the Grooming Lounge started, it was just a website. And this is like 1998.
Just the website.
Just the website.
I thought the salon preceded the website.
No, that came later. And so we started the website. I started the website, and it was cool. It was unique. It was different. Nobody was ordering anything.
It was amazing. I mean, I don't know how many people like outside of DC know how huge that impact was and how it
literally changed the marketplace.
It changed the way men groom. You know, it changed the men's grooming market and the way men groom. And, you know, we were pioneers, essentially.
100%.
You know, and so we, so anyways, I started putting it, back then there was no men's products. Nobody would give me anything to sell. I had a bunch of like five or six items, a hand cream by like Heavy Duty, you know, some brand that used to exist. This girl, Alex, used to own it. So a few folks that gave me some products. And then I put it up and nothing was happening. And so this distributorship that I worked with called Davidson's, and I knew the family, wonderful family, and then their son, and I decided to...
That's Michael Gelman.
Yeah, Michael and I decided to go into business together and to start...
So at this point, was the website called Grooming Lounge?
It was Grooming Lounge. You know, so Michael and I started working on the website together. Michael and I decided to open stores together and to really expand the concept together and see what we could do, you know, build a grooming empire, as we used to call it.
Sure.
And so we, you know, we knew right away, we're like, okay, well, there's no men's products. We have to go out and find it, or we have to create it. Mm-hmm. The second thing we knew was that if we opened a store, we would get a lot of press and PR by creating this cool environment. But we didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about shaving, you know, so I knew shaving was going to be sort of a big deal.
Hey, Peruse, neither do I.
I know. I can see. So what we did was we said, let's go out and find the perfect shave. And we did. We went out looking for the perfect shave, looking for the guy who could teach us the perfect shave, looking for someone that could help us. You know, how do you make this pain-free?
It's so incredibly interesting to me because where we are now is that's all we're seeing, right? There's so many barbering techniques. If you go on Instagram, there's so many barbers. There's this guy, A-Rod, who's a barber who just went over 1 million followers on Instagram. Well, this is amazing.
Philip Wolf, my partner, you know, business partner, he always... he brings up A-Rod all the time. I don't say anything, but deep in my heart, I'm like, you know, guys like A-Rod, I'm excited to see guys from A-Rod because that work that Michael and I did allowed for guys like A-Rod to have 1 million followers. They would know A-Rod wouldn't know us from Apple, right? But we did it, you know, and that was the reason Artist Shave popped up and opened right across the street from us, you know.
I mean, it's remarkable. It's remarkable where in the last, you know, I don't know, 12, 15 years, how that market's completely changed.
Yeah, it allowed men... You know, traditionally, you know, they just go to a barbershop, right? And a salon was kind of a woman's thing, right? So it allowed men to become more comfortable with being pampered and groomed and, you know what I mean, to have exposure to just not a traditional, you know what I mean, cut and dry barbershop.
Yeah, and the idea was to create...
or cut non-dry barbershop.
Well,
I mean,
so, what we did was, so what we did was a little different. So when we opened the stores, we set out to find a perfect shave. We traveled. We went to London. We went to this basement. The Kingsman, the Knightsbridge. I mean, you name it, all these like fancy places. And every time the two of us would come out, our face hurt like hell. Till one day I discovered a guy in New Orleans, or Michael did actually, and we found the guy in New Orleans named Aiden Gill, flew down there, and he goes, well, I'm going to teach you how to shave with a Mach 3. I'm like, are you kidding me? He goes, yeah, if you buy a computer, do you buy...
So you're saying that like where you went to the other places, they were doing straight razor shaves?
Straight razor shaves.
Okay.
So this guy is like, let me teach you how to do this with a Mach 3, and I'm like, well, why would I use a Mach 3? And he's like, if you bought a computer today, are you going to use Windows 94 or Windows 2000 or whatever? And I'm like, well, that makes a lot of sense. So he's like, let's blend. I'm going to teach you how to blend technology and tradition. So Aiden Gill taught me. I call him Yoda.
Yoda.
He taught me how to
shave.
Yoda Gill. And I told him, and it's funny, I told him, I was like, look, if you're cool, unless you want to do this together, I'm going to take this and I'm going to run with it. And I'm going to do some crazy stuff. And he was fine with it. Later on, he got pissed off, but he agreed to it because I was like, you should, you know, I'm a fair person. I want to make sure, you know, you're taken care of. But anyways, so fast forward, we do that, and then we're about to open the stores. Before we opened the stores, and once I'd learned to shave, we wanted to go out and hire barbers. When we went out and saw the quality of the barbers that were out there in terms of education, great people, but just they weren't up to par. I'm like, I can't charge 50, 60 bucks with this haircut.
No.
So I went back to my old alma mater, Graham Webb, and I spoke to Mayor, rest in peace, Christine Gordon, and I was like, look, I'm doing this. And she's like, you're kidding me. I'm like, I have this idea. I'm doing this. And what I want are students that I can take. And she's like, well, they have no barbering experience. I'm like, no, I don't want them to have barbering experience. I want them to have hairdressing experience. I'll take them from the hairdressing experience. I'll teach them retail, how to sell products, how to give them product knowledge. And then from there, we'll turn them into groomers, not barbers.
Right.
People who work with their scissors, and then when need be, they'll whip out their clippers and have the barbering skills. So it's easier to take a hairstylist and teach them how to taper than it is to take a barber and teach them how to do scissor. Sorry, texturizing or whatever.
Right.
You know, as you know this. So we started then, and so 3 months before, three months before we opened the first grooming lounge location, I rented a salon. And gave away free service, and I trained people every day and gave away free services. So that the day we opened Grooming Lounge, it was on autopilot.
That's genius.
And so we walked in.
Did free services in the salon. Did you pay the salon?
We paid the salon.
How did that work out?
It was a buddy of mine's salon. He had one, you know, he was working a chair. We paid him rent for his upstairs space. And the people that would come, and we had to pay the people, obviously, who were working with us. We were paying them like $400 a week or something like that.
Right.
And every time construction would delay, of course, we were like, oh, my God, we're losing more money. You know, we need to get in there.
The stresses of opening a business.
Yeah, exactly. So then, you know, we went ahead and finally opened, went in there. Everything was great. Went on autopilot. The first day we opened, several things happened at the grooming lounge. Okay, so the first day we opened, we were on the front cover of the Washington Post. We were on the first page of the Washington Post as two guys who were going to change the way men take care of themselves. And then that opened the door for the next 11 years. Every week, about 4 to 5 times a week, we were in the media. From Wall Street Journal to Newsweek everything.
And were they seeking you out at that point, or were you active?
Well, we were active too. We would come up with crazy ideas and funny things, or we were both, you know, one of the things that where we clicked, the two of us, was that we were both really into stunt PR.
Right.
And so we would come up with crazy ideas.
So you guys were like pre-content before content was content.
We were all over content, you know. So
that's genius.
So what we started to do was slowly, you know, we took our team first. And we were we were at one point doing, I don't know what's going on with that business because I haven't been involved, but at one point in our smallest location, we were doing in DC on L Street, 10,000 haircuts and shaves a year. 10,000.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That's incredible.
And not only that, but every single person that would come in, our retail was at about 40%.
Whoa. 40% of 10,000 haircuts?
40 to 45% retail. And you know
we can't breeze over that. We got to get into that, brother.
Sure.
What were you teaching? What were you training? How are you at 40% retail? And I also kind of wanted to go back to what you were saying before. So you taught retail first before you taught the first fade.
100%.
So kind of let's break that down a little bit. How, what, why?
Well, I did that because I felt that, you know, earlier today when we were in this class that you guys witnessed, we did a consultation with one of Ashley's stylists. When we did that consultation, if you remember, the first thing we did was we dove into retail. I mean, we dove into the consultation and talking about products and recommending the products and prescribing products.
I mean, kind of you prescribed it before you even talked about haircut or stuff.
Exactly. So we did it beforehand. And so that's what I started teaching. I started teaching people how to analyze scalps, how to diagnose it. And then everybody back then had a sink at their in their station.
Like the old barbershops.
Right. And so then we taught them how to read records like a doctor. So essentially it was like going to a doctor's office where you bring out a record, you would go over the males, whoever the male client was, you know, grooming habits, the products they'd purchased, what they'd bought before, where they're missing stuff, just notes. The first thing I taught everyone is how to take good notes.
And men were kind of new at this experience, right? So an open book, like they would just absorb whatever you guys were, because they're going from a barbershop now. A groomer.
I mean, it was funny. We were taking people who were paying $10 a ticket to $130 a ticket.
Right.
And people I would tell the stylists, I'm like, hey, if they don't come here and they don't spend this money, they're going to go buy beer. They're going to go to the strip joint. They're going to go somewhere.
Right.
So, but you're actually doing them a service by helping them out and doing this.
I bet their wives loved it too.
Oh, right? I mean, our gift certificate business, I still believe that business, from what I understand, has a decent gift certificate business. But our gift certificate business was out of control. And it was cool. It was one of the most, I couldn't even tell you. It was the fastest 11 years I've ever lived because
that's amazing.
It went by fast, man. And there was a lot happening and we were everywhere and we were wanted everywhere. I mean, I remember walking into a mall in Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico.
Yeah, exactly. At a J, doing
with the fro or no fro.
Well, no. At this point, I was getting decent haircuts. But I remember walking in front of a JCPenney's. I'll never forget this. And there was a little arena they'd built, and it was like packed with people, all waiting there for me to show up. on an El Salvadorian dentist chair. You don't even want to look at that thing. But me shaving, literally, you know. And there was no hot towel cabinet, so they had a microwave. And the first time I hit the microwave to light up, all the half the mall lost power. It was like the weirdest thing ever. But it was really cool because I was like, wow, look, even in Puerto Rico, they know who the hell we are. They knew right. what grooming lounge was or whatever. And so that changed. I mean, that was so as the years went by, I started perfecting the system, you know, training more people. So what I had happening was I would have guys come to me. Hey, I have a barber shop on the corner of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Avenue. I'm like, okay. I mean, one guy in particular, who will definitely be listening to this, so he'll appreciate this. And he came in and he's like, I've been doing this for 35 years. I'm tired of making no money. And people would literally stand in front of my desk because I had to write content all day and run a website and do all these other things. They would stand in front of my desk on mannequins, on the walls, like Karate Kid style. I would make them do exercises and then would teach them how to cut hair. The most rewarding part was watching these guys get on the floor 6 or 7 months later, working 4 days a week, making $100,000 a year being barbers. That was my goal, was to make everybody six figure people.
Once again, going back to Instagram and with some of the barbers that are out there, you hear a lot of them charging, $100 or $120 for a men's haircut or for just a fade, right? And that's just amazing that that the marketplace has changed. Like you said, when you first got into it, people were charging $10 for a haircut.
I mean,
that was the expectation. Now the expectation is so much greater than that.
Oh, 100%. And I remember being one of the first obnoxious people to charge, I don't know, it's like, you want a haircut with the owner, it was $200, $250. But guys would come in and would pay $500 because of the results we were delivering. Uh-huh. And the more products that solutions and more products we provided them, the more the retention went up. It was crazy. And so it was a system that worked. And then people with women, all these my other friends who had their unisex salons or, salons that were primarily focused on women would come, hey, come teach my staff.
But would the system work? I mean, the system would work in any salon, right?
The system, as long as you're disciplined, as long as you do it, as long as you practice, as long as you're coached through it, 100% right. would work in any salon. Yeah, and as long as you have an open mind, yeah, anything could work.
Yeah, but I know, like, from the late 90s, where my clientele was probably 95% women. Today, I say 40% of my clientele are men.
Just because men are so
fashion forward nowadays.
Yeah. And they don't want to just go somewhere and have their hair buzzed off. Because you actually cut their hair with a pair of shears and they appreciate it and you shape it right and you do all these other great things and they appreciate it. But there was none of that out back then. What happened was, after several years of doing this, what brought our partnership or the grooming lounge or all this stuff, what killed us was our egos had gotten big. I think my ego had gotten pretty big, I think.
I think it's fair.
I think, because of what was going on. And so we all had different ideas. And one of us wanted to open more stores. I wanted to create a shave club online.
Dollar Shave Club?
Where everybody laughed at me back then and said I was stupid and crazy and whatever. Because I actually had Brett Favre and Joe Montana lined up, ready to go, doing an infomercial, talking about shaving. I just thought it'd be the next progression. And then, we ended up on Home Shopping Network and, all these other things, just selling men's products. I mean, and we were successful at a lot of the stuff. There were things that we weren't successful with. But
so when you were leaving, what was your, or before you left, what was your best year? Just retail.
I tell you this. So in 2006, we were going to open in New York, and
a brick and mortar.
Yeah, my former business partner was like, I don't want to do it in New York. It's too stressful. Let's go to secondary cities like Atlanta, Charlotte. Mm-hmm. We ended up in Atlanta. Everything was good, and then the financial crisis happened. I think that was 2004, 2005. Whatever, it crashed. It just crashed. We weren't affected in the D.C. market, or our product sales weren't affected in the key markets, but in the southern markets, we were dying. I mean, we were like, you get neat alive. And so what happened was we had to, we went through two tough, we went through all these other locations were killing the locations that were making money. So when I came back before I left the grooming lounge in 2009, our best year was 2000. We made up everything we lost. So what happened was 2009 happens. On top of all this stuff, my former business partner calls me. He's like, you're not going to believe this. I'm like, what? He goes, Art of Shave literally opened across the street. I'm like, how? And he's like, they just opened. So we got all our team together. We had quite a bit of people at that point, like 80, 90 people. And even our web team, we got everybody together and we said, listen, pretend, because one of the things we practiced every week, Corey, was that we were we're training every week, right, especially on the service stuff. So we're like, let's pretend we just opened. And so take the amazing service experience that we give people and multiply it. We'll kick the crap out of the Art of Shave. It won't even matter that they're across the street.
No, go on offensive, right?
So we started doing that, and then we took all the clients that we, all the guests that we had, we're like, okay, let's see how we can grow their tickets without bringing on new, forget about new clients that come in. Let's see how we can grow these people's tickets. We started doing that too. We made back all the money we lost in Atlanta within 1 year. We made back all the money we lost in Atlanta. Wow. We made everything back. And it was a joke because we were just writing each other checks, you know, because there was just so much cash coming in from this grooming craziness, and it just made sense. But then what happened was, you know, just like every other business, you know, you get to a point where, or a partnership, or, you know, it happens in a band with bands and music quite a bit, you know, like one person has a different idea, another person has a different idea. And we weren't seeing eye to eye on a lot of things.
That's why all those boy bands, you talk about bands, that's why they separate, because everybody wants to be an individual superstar.
Yeah, we were definitely a boy. And neither one of us wanted to necessarily be an individual. I wanted to work together, but we had different ideas. I didn't think brick and mortar was a good idea to continue mm-hmm. on to. And what I wanted to do was do this shave club or whatever. So we end up, it got ugly or good and whatever you want to call it. And then we ended up, splitting up. And when we split up, I was like, I can go and deal with all this stuff. And I didn't want to spend three, 4 years in a courtroom. So I was like, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to write a book. So I went and wrote a book. Don't ask me why, on grooming. And when I wrote the book, I would take it to publishers, and publishers are like, guys don't care, blah, 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 blah. I mean, I still have it. It's an encyclopedia filled with content. I produced it all myself once I got turned down by the third publisher. So I wrote a book, and I continued in the men's space, but it was my ego that was talking. And as I continued in the men's space, I didn't know. I was like, what am I going to do? Am I going to go this way? And so I started... I was like, man, I need to, a lot of brands are always coming to me. Hey, brand my thing, fix my thing, help mm-hmm. me with my brand. And I wasn't doing anything. I'm like, I'm not a consultant and I don't want to be, I don't want to be. The consultants are these guys who come.
Do you think those people came through the growth of the grooming lounge or just your total experience?
I would say credibility, reputation.
Right.
We're in a small industry. If you sneeze in New York, they hear you in LA.
Yeah, no
and
doubt.
And the one thing I've managed to do, and I tell people all the time, I'm like, you have your reputation guarded with your life.
Sure.
You know, so never cheap out on anyone, never bullshit anyone, never whatever. Just always be, just walk a straight line, you know. And so a lot of these folks were coming through. So then what happened was a family member, a second, a distant cousin called me and he said, hey, I want to, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm doing this men's stuff and I don't know where it's going right now. The biggest problem I was having, guys, was that I would go to pitch my concept, for instance, and they're like, oh, you're like that grooming lounge thing. So I'd basically set up myself to, every time I'd go, it was like I was punching myself in the face because I'm like, oh, well, I'm kind of hindering my own success with what I created before. And the market had gotten very saturated, very crowded, and it's very difficult to sell men's products. The men's skincare and department store does not make money. Men shop a different way. A guy doesn't walk into a store and say, hey, I have a blemish on my face. Can you help me? It doesn't work that way. So it was all through recommendation. So it was tough. So this distant cousin came along, and he's like, listen, I have an idea. I'm like, what's your idea? And he goes, I'm tired. Tell me what's the problem in product manufacturing. And I said, oh, my God, now you're talking my game. Because at that point, I never...
Hey, hold on for a sec, Bruce. So we are live on Instagram right now. We just got an Instagram question. Would you want to answer it?
Sure.
So here's how it is. It's from hairstylist_tribe, which I think they just wrote a book, actually, about the business of hairdressing, if I'm not mistaken. But so the question is, has the speaking guest, that's you, considered online continuity-based company for men like Shave Club, but better promoted and positioned in our industry?
Definitely. There's a lot of line. There's to answer your question what was the name of the handle?
It was Hairstylist underscore Tribe.
To answer your question, yes, I've looked into continuity. There is a lot of, unfortunately, tricks with continuity nowadays because a lot of people have been bad in terms of product continuity. So the banks are a little harder on it when you're trying to sign people up.
Uh-huh.
The second thing is absolutely, the reason I came up with the idea of doing those shave clubs even during the grooming lounge time was to create continuity. Because as men, you know, once I like something, I don't want to go and buy it. I just want it sent to me. Like right. If I like the underwear I wear, I just want it sent to me. I don't feel like going to the store and buying it. Because think about it. Men and women, we have different shopping habits. Women go out there and gather all day, and we go in and bam, get what we want and hunt.
In and out.
So definitely. I mean, we thought about it. But when it comes to continuity, you know, it's key for men.
More questions.
Social media, how to book to get more clients in your chair. Oh, okay. Well, in terms of social media and in terms of booking on social media to get clients in your chair, my tip is that, first of all, you have to have a good social media program. And you don't have to be like my partner in crime, Philip Wolf, who goes like crazy with his social media. You can just be, look, as long as you're consistent. I don't know if you've ever, we were talking about cooking earlier.
Yeah.
Social media is like making risotto. It's like making rice. Once you pour it in, you can't stop. Otherwise, it's going to burn.
Sure.
So as long as you have a consistent, good social media program and focus on your own guests. Don't try to be everything to everyone. Start with your tribe, your small group there, and then start building for your own group. Offer tips, offer education, offer advice, things that you know that people are going to appreciate because you're a credible source.
Right.
So going back, I'm very good at picking back up where
yeah,
I was.
You're awesome, yeah. Brother.
So,
yeah.
But anyways,
I'm kind of lost.
No, going back to my distant cousin and I got together. We decided to launch a manufacturing facility.
Uh-huh.
He wanted to do it. It's his, you know, it's his money and everything. So he's like, "What's the problems in the business?" I said, "The problems in the business is that when somebody wants to create a product, they'll create a product. They have to go through 10 different channels. Before you know it, they're out of money, and no one helps them." So he's like, what if I create a facility where we do everything A through Z for people and take care of people?
Does that include packaging as well?
Packaging, but not, you know, the other stuff that we got into later. Uh-huh. So I was like, dude, you'd be a hit. And he's like, what if we hired the best people? What if we just did everything the best way? But
yeah.
He's like, what's the other problem? I said, well, the other problem is that when you're developing products, it takes, when I go into a lab and talk about something, 6 months later, 3 months later, 4 months later, I have my samples. It takes that much time. So it takes forever.
That's a long turnaround.
He's like, well, what if we did it in 2 weeks? What if we did it in 2 days? What if we were quicker? What if we beat every? And I'm like, let's do it. And he's like, oh, I'm so excited about this. I'm like, why? He's like, because, you know, he had he is in the pistachio business, and he's allergic to pistachios. He's in gravel and cement. He's in gravel.
He has, I was going to say what or not, but
right.
That's a
bad, so he was like, right. You know, I have a gravel and cement factory. I'm allergic to dust. And so on and so forth. And then everything else, he's like, he also makes light bulbs. He goes, I make light bulbs, but it's boring. I want to be around women, you know? And
yeah.
I'm like, well, there aren't that many women around in manufacturing, but sure. So we started what's called, he started and I helped out what's called Happy Farm Botanicals, which is in Odenton, Maryland, which is now he's building a new facility out in Hightsville, uh-huh. Which is state of the art. It's amazing. And it'll be the first plant where you can make everything from aerosol to makeup. You basically make everything from except makeup pencils or whatever. So coloring pencils for the eyes or whatnot. So that started. When that started, at that point, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was a little, you know, I was like, you know, do I go back into the professional beauty side of the business kept uh-huh. pulling me in, and I kept, mm-hmm. it's like the Godfather. Just when I thought I'm out, you know,
they
me
pull
back.
You back in.
So I was like, I don't want to deal with it, and I want to do this, and I just want to, I didn't know. So right along the time I was doing that, two things happened. One was that a guy comes into the factory and says, hey, I love what you guys are doing. I want you guys to build me a design line for me.
Right.
But I heard that grooming guy, you know, that guy who did all the thing in the grooming world, and he's done that kids thing, and they're like, yeah, I guess. I heard he's associated with this.
Right.
I'll give you my business if that guy helps coach me, brand me, and take my product to the market. So they call me, and they're like, hey, would you be interested in this? And I'm like, okay, sure, why not?
Mm-hmm.
And that one guy turned into two guys, another brand, and it just started multiplying. So I had this, you know, nice consulting business, minding my own business. And then one day I see on the internet, I see Wolf Bear. And I'm like, what the hell is this? You know, I look around, and I'm like, what is this? And I look, and it's my Philip, we all know, Philip Wolf. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, what is he doing? You know, and I'm reading it. So I get in the, I link up with Philip and Chief, and they're like, I told them, they're like, you know, why aren't you in the pro side of the business? I was like, well, here's what's happening in the professional beauty world, and here's why I think it's broken. And they're like, what's up? And I'm like, well, first of all, consolidation is killing everyone. And when I saw Philip and Chief, I was, you know, wondering, I was like, you know, what are these guys doing? So we get on the phone. We start talking about what's wrong with the industry. And I told him, I was like, look, through the consolidation has created expansion on the shelves. This is what these people are doing. Everyone's buying each other out. You know, private equity, you know, all these like bottom feeders have gotten involved in our business. So they're sucking the life out of the brands. There's no personalities. There's no, all the stuff that we grew up loving and liking and we're excited about. They're all gone. And so I told them, I was like, this is a problem. And so this is happening. This expansion on the shelves is creating an extinction. And they're like, well, what's being extinct? I'm like, the stylist.
It's kind of just eating themselves.
The industry is broken. There's something wrong with the industry. And I was like, and I said, look, it's very similar to the NFL. When a guy is bad in one place, they hire him in another place, and they hire him in another place. It was just the same people being recycled. And the people that are running the corporate side of things have no clue as to what the hell is happening behind the chair.
Right.
You know, nobody. And so they're like, well, what do you, and they wanted to create a movement, and we decided to start working together on Wolf Bear. And so I hadn't gone to a pro hair show in a while. I mean, I realized I grew up in these things. Right. So I show up, another question, I show up, and, you know, and these guys were like, hey, everybody, you know, everyone's rubbing my head like I'm 5 years old. And he's like, he's like, everybody at these shows know you, or at the show know you. This is in Premiere in Orlando. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, they've known me since I was a kid. Where the hell have you been? Why aren't you around? What, everything, nothing. Me staying away from hair shows in 15 years because I kept the grooming lounge out of that. You know, I didn't want to compete against American. We were different.
Right.
Nothing had changed. Everything was the same, except people were louder, bigger music, bigger stages. You know, the same music
from 1990.
Same garbage or whatever. So I was walking in, and we were looking at this booth, and we were like, what in the hell is this? And there was people skateboarding and doing all sorts of stuff. And we started laughing at it. So it's myself, Philip Chief, and a gentleman named Pat Neville that I work with closely, who's a very famous industry consultant. And we were like, what is this? And they were like, oh, this is Peter Coppola. And we're like, why do they have skateboarders there? You know. So we sat there, and we were laughing. Mm-hmm. Until 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from Jane Morehouse, who's another industry icon.
Uh-oh. What? Nothing. What? Go ahead.
No. So I get a call from Jane Morehouse, and Jane is like, you know, I want you to meet the people from Coppola. And I went and met them. And what I found was a company that was in distress, a company that, you know, they had very lovely people, wonderful people, but really bad products, really bad branding. It was very confused messaging. It was all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so I was perfectly fine. I was running my own little consulting business, and then they asked me to join, and I joined.
So when you joined, did you pull out your rollerblades?
I didn't pull out my rollerblades.
Ride those ramps?
No, they all. You know, I joined as a COO, and you know, and I'm not into titles. I don't really care about those things. It means nothing to me. I, you know, I'm all about the actual person. So I joined as a COO, and. And even though I'm not you can find a million people to operate a business. I'm a branding guy. I bring in a different skill set. So we started it, and you know, from there, Peter Coppola, you know, we started reformulating and redoing the whole thing. And Philip and Chief helped me because we were all working on Wolf Bear, and then we started getting involved in certain aspects of it. Next thing you know, another product line comes along called Grow, and we take Grow on, which you guys, it's the mushroom ergothionine thing that I've told you guys about.
Sure.
And then, you know, Beth Minardi, and then so on and so forth. And
so you're with Beth Minardi now, so you can't breeze over Beth Minardi, bro.
No, we're not even breezing. I'm not even breezing over it. But the thing is that next thing you know, it went from being Peter Coppola and turned into personal brands. And I'm, you know, me, I'm very direct. I'm very honest. And I sat back, you know, even I. Good amount of time has gone by, and I sat back a little while ago, and I'm like, okay, now I'm at a point again in my life, and it's very interesting that we're doing this podcast, because I think the exciting part of this podcast is that the next time I'm with you, life could be different, you know, in so many great ways. So I sort of sat back a few weeks ago, and I was reflecting, And it's something that I encourage people to do. You know, one of the things I tell people is like, read as much as you can every day, reflect every day, you know, step out and reflect. It's mm-hmm. really important to have that thinking time. So I was reflecting. And when I was having these reflections, I sort of stood back and I was like, okay, well, what is my legacy going to be in the next 10 years? What do I want to do? And how can I make a difference? And what can I do to make an impact in the industry that I love? And so I was like, okay, well, I have these three things that I bring to the picture. One is I'm a good coach. Mm-hmm. Two is that I can brand anything and, you know, and market it and get it out there. And the third part is that I was like, you know, I want to finish the mission that Philip and Chief and I started, which is Wolf Bear. And so so now I'm at a stage right now where, you know, I've put my magic touch into personal brands. I've built the lines. I've built the formulas. I've built the library. I've set them up.
So just for my own curiosity, so is personal brands, is that the same as the manufacturing, or is it?
The manufacturing is called Happy Farms. That has nothing to do with it. They just partner.
So that's just where the products are made. So everything that happens before that or during that.
The beauty of Happy Farms. Let me tell you, the beauty of Happy Farms is that, again, if today you're working with any lab around the country, when you want to just try calling them, try to make a change in a product, try to get something sent to you within 24 hours or 48 hours.
Right.
Try to work with someone who's not going to shove 15,000 items or something down your throat, who's willing to go to bat with you so that to see if your concept is viable.
Right.
And it could be proven. So that's what Happy Farms does, which is great, which I promote. And besides it being, I'm connected to it through family, I just think it's a wonderful tool for people.
Sure.
Personal brands, though. Personal brands is a family-run-owned business. It's owned by the Davidson family. Pat Neville's the CEO, mm-hmm. Who I work with. And it's just a great family business that has it's multi-line. And the Davidsons are wonderful people because the Davidsons really care about... They're just good people that... they're just great people. I don't know how to say it. It's very hard. It's very rare that you meet owners mm-hmm. in this business like those folks.
That's awesome. How many brands does Personal Brands carry now, or represent, or however?
We're lined up to do anywhere from 5 to 6. Currently, mm-hmm. Right now, the three that are active that have hit the market are Peter Coppola, the mm-hmm. new Peter Coppola, which is the Empowering Beauty line, which we talked about here today.
Right.
Grow. The Daily mm-hmm. Vitality Boost, and Beth Minardi. And like mm-hmm. you said yourself, Beth Minardi on its own is like having three lines, man.
No doubt.
There's a lot involved there.
And she's got long arms in this industry,
yeah,
right?
And Beth is, Beth is, again, someone who, in a short period of time, helped me change my work style. You know, we banged heads a little bit because you got mm-hmm. two creative people.
Sure.
But, you know, somebody inspires me, but I admire a great deal. And
I think we all do. Yeah. I mean, we're all of that age where...
She's a legend.
She's a legend. Yeah, you talk about legacy. You know, she has hers, and that's just pretty amazing that you're working with her.
No, so, I mean, so that, I think I... gave you a short, I tried to make it as short as possible, but that's my life, man. And today I'm here with Ashley and, you know, doing some training and, you know, having
Hi,
some
Ashley.
Fun.
We want to thank her again
for allowing us to have us into the salon and letting us.
Look, I mean, the most rewarding part of all, like to see her success is just, you know.
That's pretty amazing.
It inspires me to go out and do more.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Perus, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on your day off.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Pleased to meet you. So there it is. We also want to give a special thanks to Sarah and Blaine from Pretty Gritty. Sarah and Blaine allowed us to use their music that runs under the podcast. It's called Pleased to Meet You, which I thought was only appropriate for our podcast. You can find Pretty Gritty's music on iTunes.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.